First Corinthians chapter 10 is where we're going to be tonight. And this is a passage that I'm sure we've heard and have read ourselves. And it's one that until recently, I didn't really ever notice that what Paul does here, if you think 1 Corinthians 10 and you read all of it there, the real memorable passages that we usually think about in this is that that there's no temptation that overtakes you that's not already common to man, but with that temptation, God will make the way of escape. And that idea of taking heed to yourself when you think that you stand, lest you fall. There's those cautions. It's what comes before that that is it's interesting to me. And so Paul gives the church at Corinth what is ultimately a history lesson. But it's a history lesson of the children of Israel. Now, by the time that Paul writes this, remember, when you look back to Abraham, which is really kind of the beginning, if you will, of the children of Israel, because it's Abraham to Isaac to Jacob to the sons, their time in the captivity there in Egypt, all of that takes place from the time that Abraham is told those things until they're taken out is hundreds of years, 500 plus, from the time that Isaac was born until the time that they're coming out after the Exodus. And so it's just a real fascinating kind of a thing to think about, that the limit of their history. You have the time of the judges, you have the time that Joshua brought them in, you have the time of the kings, as Paul writes this to the church at Corinth, a bunch of Gentiles nonetheless. But in the four examples that he gives us in the first part of this chapter, it's only the four episodes are from that 40 years of their sojourn after they left in the Exodus till the time that they came into the Promised Land. So of all of that 2,000 years of history, the examples that he gives to the church at Corinth there is taken from just 40 years of the time in the wilderness. And it intrigued me when I first kind of thought of that. Well, why would he zero in on that? And the only takeaway is that there's no good answer for it. There's no way that I can prove it. But just trying to get into the mind of Paul and considering what it's like that in that part of the world there in Corinth, what an amazing thing it must have been for them to see kind of, if you will, the parallels. Because think about the people that had come out of Egypt from that time of slavery. And think about what God had given to them. Now, remember, Egypt is used in a symbolic way of slavery to sin. And so they were enslaved. There's no question about that. They were in servitude to the nation of Egypt. And then Paul and others would talk to us about the slavery that sin has to the life of the believer. And in that, God has given us a deliverer. He's given us a law as well. There's a law that's by grace. He's our redeemer. All of those kind of things, you know, he's the one who goes before us. All of those truths that we know as far as the church, they had those same things. So God breaks them free of their bondage. He's taking them to a place that they've never seen before. So every place that they stepped when they left Egypt until they came into the land of the promise was a sojourn. They were just pilgrims. They were strangers in that place, but they were on their way to a different destination, which is the same thing that you find with us here as far as the church is concerned. Yeah, we live here in this world, but it's a sojourn. There's a pilgrimage because this is not the final destination. We're going somewhere else. So when you start to see the parallels, it's pretty interesting. Then you read the four examples that he gives there, and you would think, so what do those four examples have to do with a church in Corinth? Because again, Paul's not writing to the 21st century church. He's writing to the church there at Corinth in the first century. So what changes in 20 centuries of time? Why we would look at this and see, is there any parallels for us as well? And that's all the stuff that I want to examine with you. We're going to look at just the first 11 verses in this chapter. And the first part of it is just kind of their common history. It's what you have in the first five verses. And the question is Paul talking about our fathers, like Paul being able to speak as a Jew and speaking of himself and those that were also Jewish? Or does he also include the church there? And there's debate as to whether or not he's saying our fathers. And so as far as Gentiles getting saved and part of the church, how would we be able to say the people of a Jewish background that they're also our fathers? Well, because the promise goes back to Abraham, and it was through Abraham's line that the nations, us, the generations of man would be blessed, not just Jews, but Jews and Gentiles alike, because Jesus paid the price for the sin of mankind. Whether you are Jew or Gentile, the blood atones for all man and woman, men and women that would come to him by faith. So, you know, you can make the case for either of those things. But what he wants them to do is have kind of an ownership of recognizing we need to know what had taken place in times past, because what God did then, it was going to speak volumes about what he would do when Jesus came in and completed all the things that were left incomplete in the Old Testament. Because I think I've even shared this here in times before, but the law was really great about identifying what sin is, identifying the consequence of sin, and even providing what would be a temporary solution to sin, and that would be the sacrifices, but it could never do away with it. It was the one fatal flaw of the law that it could not put away sin. And so in Jesus, we have that final resolution. We have a solution to the problem. And sin has now been, it has been conquered, and death itself has also been conquered by his resurrection. And that's the promise to us. And so Jew or Gentile alike, we all have those same promises. So verses 1 through 11, let's just read them very quickly, and we'll go back and look at them in some detail. Moreover, he says in verse 1, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all of our fathers were under the cloud, all passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in that sea. All ate of the same spiritual food. All drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of the spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Jesus. It was Christ. But with them, with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should no longer lust after evil things as they also lusted, and do not become idolaters as some of them were, or as it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink, and they rose up to play. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ as some of them tempted and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor complain as some of them also complained and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, all of these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. So, Father, we pray that you would give us understanding and open our eyes to the scripture as we see it here. We would ask, God, that as we spend this time looking at your word, that you would speak to our own hearts and minds and help us to understand what was being said to the church here at Corinth, and why would it apply to us here in the 21st century? May we be wise, and may you, again, open our eyes to this truth, and we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen? So it is verse 11, the two parts of this, that these things were written, first and foremost, to the church at Corinth. These things are written, Corinthians, for our examples. They're put there, and they're examples to us, and they're there for our admonition. So those two things, these are examples, like if he wants to say, we should abstain from immorality, we should abstain from idolatry and from backbiting and complaining and murmuring and even to the place of apostasy. We should avoid those things. For instance, we can see that it's happened to the children of Israel. And so the exhortation or the admonition is don't do what they did. So that's why this is here, and this is why he gives these examples. So when we look at the four examples, that's where there's a pretty much a direct, I believe, way that he could say, this is your day-to-day life. Imagine Corinth. If you know where Corinth is, if you can find it on a map, think modern-day Greece. Think the right next door to Athens, a little bit to the west of Athens, and remember what Athens was like when Paul went there. It's Acts chapter 17. And remember, he's in Athens because he was up further up into Macedonia, and they wanted to kill him. That's that whole Berea, Thessalonica, all of that stuff. They put him on a boat and they get him out of there, and he goes to Athens, and of course he's going to make trouble there too, because they don't want to hear what he's got to say, although they are a little different in that they're interested, they're kind of intrigued by it. But chapter 17 is where you see that he's walking around looking at all of the idolatry, and then he sees, remember that one rock, it says to the unknown God? He sees it as an opportunity. I want to tell you about that one. And so that's what he does. That just tells you that there is all of that kind of idolatry that's taking place. But what we know of that paganism is that the hedonistic part of it and the sensuality and the immorality things would be a part of that temple worship. And if you're going to do something like what they were being entertained to do, Go back to where you came from, the idolatry and the hedonism and all the rest of it. Go back to that thing. That's the draw. And so, again, in our modern days, is it not kind of the same thing? We're always being entertained to come back to the exact same thing where we left. You know, it's just the easy thing to do. So, again, he goes through what is a common history of the children of Israel in the first five verses. He talks about those things. Were they not all the same? So the people that were brought out of Egypt, they had that in common. They are the descendants of Abraham. They are of the tribes, the sons of Jacob, and God brings them out. There was a common bond between them. Now he says this, and here's the first of the four examples. Verse 7 is this. Do not become idolaters as some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and to drink, and they rose up to play. We're going to go take a look at that because it's in the book of Exodus. And this is when Moses is up getting the law. So I don't think that when Paul says this, he's expecting us to just go, oh yeah, that's when Moses came down and they had made the golden calf. I believe what Paul would have them to do is to go back and really fully understand what took place there. So go back and read the whole of this rather than just the citation of it, of what happened. It's actually to go back and read the whole of the matter. So this is found in the book of Exodus chapter 32. Let's go there. Because again, it is incredibly instructive, and it's probably a good reminder to us. When we hear something maybe referenced, it's good that we understand the reference, but it's probably even better if we go back and read the entirety of it, because there's so much more than just a verse if you can read the entire episode, everything that happened there at the time. Now, when we read this, it just shows you something that can escape our understanding. Because again, let me ask you this way. When it comes to the idea of what is the golden calf, and I say it's when Moses was getting the law and he comes down and he finds out that Aaron and the rest of the people are worshiping a golden calf. How many of us remember the story? So most all of us, if not all of us. It's when you go back and read it, go, oh, it's so much worse than I remembered. So if it's been a while since you've been through Exodus 32 and you read this, you go, oh my gosh, it really was pretty bad what they did there. Well, let's read it. And I believe this is what Paul would have us to do if we were in Corinth. So we read in verse 1 of chapter 32, when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered together to Aaron, and they said to him, come, make us gods, plural, small g, make us gods that they shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man that brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. Now, again, he's up getting the law. And they're going, he's been gone a while. We don't know what happened to him. So, Aaron, what we need you to do is make us gods that we can worship. What they're going back to is what was Egypt. That's what they're familiar with. They want to do that. Now, who is Aaron? By this time, Aaron is the high priest. This is the guy. Well, this is where he's going to come from. This is the guy that's left in charge in Moses' absence. So instead of him saying, get out of here, you guys are crazy, we're not going to go do that, God has taken us away from all that stuff. He should be the voice of reason. Instead, he's just as complicit as the rest of them. Watch what happens. So Aaron said to them, all right, well, basically, we'll find out if you guys are really invested in this. Take the earrings of gold off of your ears and that of your wives, your sons, your daughters, bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings, which were in their ears, and they brought them to Aaron. Now, what it doesn't tell us is, was this a challenge? All right, you guys really want that? Let's see how much you want to do it. Give me all of your gold. Or was he just like, okay, well, the only way we can do this is if you guys chip in. Like, is he going to be in for this? Well, it sure seems like he joins in. So all the people broke them off. They gave it to him. So in verse 4, he received the gold from their hand. He fashioned it with an engraving tool, and he made a molded calf. And then he said, this is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt. How crazy is that? Now read on the rest. So when Aaron saw it, he built an altar before it, and he made a proclamation, said to them, tomorrow is the feast of the Lord. And then they rose early on the next day, offered burnt offerings, and they brought peace offerings. And the people sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play. Notice that last little phrase is what we see in 1 Corinthians. But we haven't even really tackled the rest of what's there. But Look at what has taken place. The people come to Aaron. We don't know what happened to Moses, so you're the next in line, and here's what we want. We want to go back to the idolatry of Egypt, and it's your responsibility to make sure that we do that. But they try to mix the two things together. It's a feast to the Lord, but the object of your worship is a calf. So you're trying to merge what we did in Egypt in our bondage along with this sanctified thing that God has called his children. How do you mix those things? And frankly, the church does it a lot today. And so it must have been doing it as well here, because this is what they're asking, and Paul is trying to use this as a caution. Look at verse 7. So the Lord said to Moses up on the mountain, "Go down, for your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt has corrupted themselves." Now, notice what God does here. He makes Moses take ownership of this. Those people that you brought out. Now, Moses doesn't argue with him, because Moses could have said, "I'm sorry, I wasn't one of the part of the Red Sea. I didn't kill the firstborn. I didn't do the plagues. That was you, God." But then again, remember, Moses was the instrument that God would use to be his mouthpiece and to do all those things. So there was that. Again, he's having Moses take ownership, because Moses is going to have a decision to make here. Look at verse 8. It says, "They have turned aside quickly out of the way that I commanded them, and they have made themselves a molded calf, and they've worshipped it, sacrificed to it, and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, that brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And so the Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and indeed they are stiff-necked people. Now, therefore, let me alone, that my wrath may burn hot against them, that I may consume them, and I will make of you a great nation.'" Now, as I think about that once again, can you imagine? God is completely in his rights to do exactly what he has said that he's going to do. But this really puts it in front of Moses. Moses, will you be the intercessor for the people? Because it will be your advocacy and your intercession that will prevent God from doing what he could rightfully do. And I don't think we realize it so often when we read these things. If God, of course, knew how that was going to play out, he knew how Moses would handle this. He knew how Paul would answer the call that he put upon his life. He knew Abraham's answer when he made the offer to him, "Come and I'll make a nation out of you." All of those kind of things. We know for sure God knows what the answer is going to be, but it is not a disingenuous thing that God does by offering. It still requires the person having the offer made to them to act upon it. So clearly Moses does that. Look at what he says. Moses pleaded with the Lord and said, "Lord, why does your wrath burn hot against your people whom you brought out of the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand?" So in some way, he kind of puts it back there and says, we're both in this. God shows Moses his participation and the importance of it. And likewise, Moses is going to say, "God, it was you who did this." And not in a way of kind of pointing blame. That's us. We do that pointing, "Well, you did it first." No, it's rather, this is a major, it's a pivotal point in their history. Everything would have changed if Moses had said, "Yeah, you know what? They deserve it. Go ahead. And we'll start something brand new," which they could have done exactly that. So here's what Moses' concern is, and I believe that this is genuine. It's not that he's trying to coerce God into something. God could see right through that. His concern is that, look at all of what you have done, and if you do exactly what you're saying, which you could rightfully do, imagine how that's going to look to the people who can't stand us. So he advocates for the people. Why should the Egyptians speak and say, "He brought them out to harm them, to kill them in the mountains, and to consume them from the face of the earth?" So turn from your fierce wrath and relent from the harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by your own self and said to them, "I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven. And this land that I have spoken of, I give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever." And so the Lord relented from doing harm, and he said that he said he would do to the people. Now read on at verse 19. "So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, he saw the calf and the dancing, and so Moses' anger became hot." And notice it was God who had said, "I'm angry with what's taking place there." Moses sees it for himself and has the same reaction, which is a good thing. Now, the idea that people can become kind of, you know, well, it is what it is, become complacent and somewhat, you know, go along to get along kind of thing. He didn't do that, and it's an important matter. "So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands, broke them at the foot of the mountain. And that's just out of sheer frustration and anger. God gives them a new set, we all know. Verse 20, so he then took the calf, which they had made, burned it in the fire, and then he ground it to powder, scattered it on the water, and made the children of Israel drink it. Can you imagine what that would have looked like? Hey, this thing that you were just dancing around that said took you out of Egypt, now what? It's ground into powder enough that it floated, and he made them drink it. So imagine that. With this God that we think is somehow powerful, we can actually put it in a glass of water and drink it. It was intended to make them see how ridiculous this whole thing was. Verse 21, so Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. Look at that, pointing the blame. Hey, wait a minute, aren't you the guy? You're the one who did what they said. Look at what he ends up doing. For they said, make us gods that we should that they should go before us. As for this Moses, the man that brought us out of the land of Egypt, we don't know what has become of him. And so again, the people missed the whole point. Who brought him out of Egypt? Moses was the guy that was the focus, but once again, Moses did not part the Red Sea. Moses did not bring the plagues. God did all of that, and now they're just focused on one guy that we don't know where he is. Well, given everything that's happened so far, just wait for him to show back up, because God clearly has a plan here. They forgot all of that. Now look at what Aaron does. So I said to them, whoever then has gold, let them break it off. And so they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. You're a liar. You made this thing. So again, just trying to cover his own tracks. Now, the church at Corinth, if they were to know the entirety of this, they would go back and think, well, what's the highlights of this whole thing? God brings them out, and because they become impatient, they go back to the same idolatry and debauchery that God judged a nation over to get them out of it. And here they're going right back to that same thing. Now, if you're the church in Corinth, and that's all that you see everywhere around you is idolatry, and it's always saying, just come back, it's the easy thing to do. It would be a great caution to say to it's one thing if Paul was just to say, don't be put off by all of the idolatry. Instead, he's able to say, don't be put off by the idolatry because, hey, we have a precedent for this. Look at what happened with the children of Israel in the early time right after they were taken out at the Exodus, and look at what they did. Learn from their lessons. And again, when he says that this is written for our admonition and these things are our examples, just ask yourself the question, would you rather make a mistake or would you rather learn from somebody else? I don't know about you. I'd rather see somebody else get their nose skinned up and then not go through it myself. Well, this is kind of the reasoning that, of course, he does with this. Now, let's go back to 1 Corinthians 10. And you may as well keep your finger there because we're going to go back and forth between these examples. So the first one is don't become idolatrous. So to the church at Corinth, the next one that he wants to tackle is don't become immoral. And this is found in Numbers chapter 22. But let's go ahead and then read verse 8. Nor let us commit sexual immorality as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Now, you're going to notice when we read this in Numbers, the number that they give there is 24,000. And it is when Paul is quoting what we believe from the Septuagint. If you know what the Septuagint is, it's the Greek translation from the Hebrew text done by Jewish people because they wanted to preserve the integrity. So Paul and the Septuagint say 23, the regular translations that we have of the Old Testament just in our manuscripts says 24. Again, it's very easy to make that difference just in the Hebrew writing. The numbers are not quite as easy for us. It's very easy oversight. Doesn't change the story at all. It's just the number of people that are mentioned here. And they give a lot of reasons why there might be the discrepancy. But if you're the type that tracks this down, you go, wait a minute, I heard it was 23 in one and 24 in another. So I just figured I'd throw that out there to confuse you. kidding. Anyway, you'll see. It's one says 23,000, one says 24,000. It doesn't change the fact that some really ugly stuff took place. Numbers 22. And really this runs chapters 22 through 25. We're not going to read anywhere near that much. I'm just going to kind of go over the big pieces of this. So Numbers 22 is where we start. And this is the whole Balaam and Balak thing, right? So we know that. Balaam's donkey. That whole We know it from the children's ministry version, right? So this is actually more of the genuine detail that took place. Let's read the first six verses here. So it says, "Now the children of Israel moved, and they camped in the plains of Moab, on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho." Now this is very late into the process. They've made their way all the way up to what is the doorstep of coming into the promised land. Moab is on the other side of the Jordan. You can see where this area would be from Israel. You can see the general area. It's just there to be seen. So Balak, the son of Zippor, saw that Israel had done to the Amorites. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because there were so many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So Moab said to the elders of Midian, "Now this company will lick up everything around us, and as an ox licks up the grass of the field." And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at that time. Then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, "Look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth, and they are settling next to me. Therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land, for I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." Isn't that an interesting thing? He doesn't even realize that he is quoting exactly what God said to Abraham. "I will bless those who bless you, and I will curse those who curse you." My guess is in all the back and forth that Balaam actually had with God, he probably reminded him of that. "Hey, I heard what Balak had to say about you being able to bless and curse people. Let me tell you about what I said to Abraham. I said that whoever blesses is going to be blessed, and whoever curses you is going to be cursed. Now, Balaam, you might not want to try this." Besides that, God told him repeatedly, "You want me to do something I am unwilling to do. I will not curse my people." So it's when we get to chapter 31. Let me just give you the reference. We won't read it. But in chapter 31, verses 1 to 6 also of Numbers, is where we find out how it was that Balaam ultimately got God to judge his people. And he did it in this way. He said, "Send your women to entice the men there, and not only in the sexual way, but also in the idolatrous way. And what you'll do is get God to judge them because he's forbidden such practices. I can't do directly what you're asking me to do, Balak, but I'll tell you how you can get there in a roundabout way." Just evil, evil counsel. So then turn forward to chapter 25 of Numbers, and we read this, starting at verse 1. "Now Israel remained at the acacia grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab." And the harlotry there is not necessarily what we would think in the way of prostitution, but this is a spiritual harlotry as much as anything else. Verse 2, "They invited the people to the sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and they bowed down to their gods." So when in Rome, or in this case, when in Moab, do as the Moabites, right? So the guys were enticed by the women. They introduced them to the idolatry. They did all of those things just as Balaam said to Balak. Here's how you get there. Verse 3, "So Israel was joined to Baal at Peor, and the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. And the Lord said to Moses, 'Take all the leaders of the people and hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel.'" Make an example of those people who did this. Verse 5, "So Moses said to the judges of Israel, 'Every one of you kill his men who are joined to Baal at Peor.' And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses and in the sight of all the congregation of Israel who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now, when Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron the priest, saw it, he rose up among the congregation, took a javelin in his hand, and he went after the man of Israel, went into the tent and thrust both of them through, the man of Israel and the woman through her body. So the plague was stopped among the children of Israel, and those who died of that plague were 24,000. So, once again, Paul can say this. Look at, again, what all of what we just read there. Here's all that Paul says about that in verse 8 of 1 Corinthians 10. Don't commit sexual immorality as some of them did and 24,000 or 23,000 died. It's when you go back and read the rest of this that it puts a lot of meat on that bone. So if Paul was saying to the church at Corinth, don't be drawn away to commit spiritual harlotry and don't become involved in the sexual immorality, just like Israel did, you guys have the same thing in front of you. God forbids that you do, but it's right there for you to do. Now that it's, you can do that, but let me show you what happened as far as Israel is concerned. There's nothing new under the sun, to quote Solomon, right? So to the church at Corinth, first two lessons, do not fall into idolatry and the idolatry that will ultimately lead to the same kind of sexual sin that they did. Be careful, is what he is telling them. And he has still two more to go. So in verse 9, back in 1 Corinthians, he says, nor let us tempt Christ as some of them tempted and were destroyed by serpents. So this is, again, one of those interesting, just to me, fascinating bits of their history found in chapter 21. So notice, this is right before the whole Balaam thing, right? Now, what we realize, and we would like to say it's just them, but Israel in the wilderness just like to complain about everything. And if they couldn't find something to complain about, they would invent something. It's just kind of a human thing. We all do it. It's how we're wired. So chapter 21, before the whole Balaam thing, here's what they end up doing with this. And this is a repeating problem that you find so often in their history. So verse 5 in chapter 21 is this. It says, the people spoke against God and against Moses, asking this question, why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die in the wilderness? For there is no food, there is no water, and our soul loathes this worthless bread. That's the manna. Now, this is the thing that keeps them alive, and they find a way to complain about it. Now, it's funny. Every time I'm in this passage, I'm always reminded of something I saw. It was National Geographic or Discovery or one of those things. And they were trying to explain, if you've ever watched those shows where they try to explain all the miracles in the Bible, they're just like, that is so lame. And you actually were trying to put that out there as though that's an explanation. Well, this was one where they showed this plant that grows in the desert. And when it blooms, it has this little white puffy thing that is actually edible. And they say, you know, in this part of the world, this is something that pops up and it's edible. This must be what the manna was. And so if we understand the scriptures, we would say, I have a question. What about in the times when that isn't blooming? Because they had to eat every day, didn't they? Most humans do. So, and how is it that a little plant like that would know how to preserve itself for 2 days over the Sabbath, but it would always rot overnight? How did it know? That's the smartest plant I've ever seen in my life. So, of course, it's just man trying to explain away the miraculous. And you expect unbelievers to try to do that. They want to make it something less than it is. So anyway, I just always laugh about those. I know I probably don't have time to do it, but I'm going to do it anyway. There was one that was the parting of the Red Sea. Maybe you guys have seen this. But there was somebody who was trying to explain that the children of Israel went to a particular part of what is actually known as the Reed Sea, not the Red Sea. So it's much shallower. And when there are these really strong winds, like it tells us, the east wind that hit the water and it parted, that it's really because the water was just only very, very shallow. And when that wind hit it, it just started to separate it. And the guy wanted to prove it. He had this big acrylic tank. And he had put the sand in it the right way. And he actually got up on a ladder and used a leaf blower to blow wind on it and show that you could expose that front part of it. So, of course, you know, you just go, well, this is the punchline to the whole thing. What's the greater miracle? That God could part the sea or that he could drown the Egyptian army in 2 feet of water? Either way, you have a bona fide miracle in front of your hands. You can't get around it. So just man trying to explain away the miraculous. It's comical and tragic. So back to what we're reading here in the book of Numbers. So at verse 6, they complain about the manna. In verse 6, it says, so the Lord sent fiery serpents among the people, and they bit the people, as many as the people of Israel, and many, rather, of the people of Israel died. Therefore, the people came to Moses and said, we have sinned, for we have spoken against the Lord and against you. Pray to the Lord that he take away the serpents from us. And so Moses prayed for the people. And the Lord said to Moses, make a fiery serpent, and made it out of bronze, brazen serpent. Set it on a pole, and it shall be that everyone who is bitten, when they look at it, shall be, or they shall live. So Moses made this bronze serpent, put it on a pole, and so it was, if the serpent had bitten anyone, that they looked at the bronze serpent, they would live. Now, when I read that, once again, this will tell you how I read the Bible, and I don't know how you read it, but when I read that thing there, I just go, if I'm in that place and God says that, I'm going to go, let me make sure I understand this. You want me to make what looks like a snake out of bronze, put it on a pole, put it in the middle of anyone, and if they're bitten by what is a venomous snake that's already killed a whole bunch of people, tell them if they just look at that and trust that they won't die from the snake bite, that will save them? Make sure I have this right. I would be that kind of a cynical person. I am, and I shouldn't be. Because what God is wanting them to do, wants Moses to do, is something that makes absolutely no sense. Because if it did, and if there was some kind of a, I want you to take this plant, and I want you to add this to it, and this, you know, make a tincture and all that stuff, and if you do all of this stuff in just the right formula, then you can give them something that would be an antidote to the snake bite. Moses would take credit for that. In this case, you're asked to do something that is completely nonsensical. It's impossible. How is that going to fix anything? That's exactly the question that you would want to ask, because it's not supposed to make sense. It's a supernatural thing that God provides. And it's even more important than that, because Jesus uses it as an example himself. So we all know John 3:16. God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, right? That whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. John 3:15 says the same thing in a portion of it, because it says that whoever believes in him will not perish, but have eternal life. That's verse 15. It's verse 16 that gives the identifier as to, well, how do we know that? It's because God so loved the world. So read it, John 3:15 and John 3:16. John 3:16 is a repetition of verse 15. The only thing that's added in 16 is, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son. What we a lot of times do not know is what's in verse 14. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. So he points back to something that's in their history, this same thing, Numbers chapter 21, and it said, remember, Jesus' audience is purely Jewish. So when he talks about the serpent on the pole, they know exactly what it is. And I have to laugh about this, because it just, again, it's such a great commentary on man. This bronze serpent was, it ended up being worshipped down the line. You guys remember that? And so they called it, they had a name for it. Do you remember what the name of they called it Nehushtan, which means that bronze thing. So you basically want to say to you guys, so you're worshipping that bronze thing. Go shake yourself. Why are you doing that? It was never put there as an object of worship to begin with, but man's just that way. It was really significant at one time. It's a relic. So what are you going to do with it? Well, let's go worship it. It's important. God never told you to do that. Remember the last time that something was fashioned and they worshiped it? Yeah, Moses ground it to powder and you guys had to drink it. Get a grip. This stuff is, again, it's comical and tragic all at the same time. It's just astounding. And I like to basically say I would never do such a thing, but I suppose if I was there, I might have been just, you know, go along with the crowd. So, again, John 3 is where we get Jesus alluding to this. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must the Son of Man be lifted up. Jesus also says in John chapter 8, he says, now, if I am lifted up, speaking above the earth, on a tree, on a cross, I will draw all man to myself. So that this idea of the recognition by looking up at something like that, remember, by it being bronze, It's God saying, I've made a judgment on what you have done. I have sent these serpents as a judgment to you, but in that judgment, I will also make a way for you to be saved from your rebellion and from your sin. Here's what I'm going to ask you to do. I'm going to ask you to look at the serpent on a pole and trust that I've given you provision for your sin. Oh man, no wonder Jesus uses that as an example. As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, so must I be lifted up to the cross. So we would look at the same thing and just say, so what did Jesus accomplish there? His blood was shed because that was the price of ransom. It was the sentence against us was death. So something innocent, in this case, someone who was innocent was going to pay for my guilt, and he was going to do so in his own blood. So all of that is the imagery that you see. First of all, it's a judgment for sin in the book of Numbers. But in Jesus, it's also the same thing, but it's a permanent solution for the sin of all mankind. Amazing. So back to 1 Corinthians for the last of these. And this has a lot of text, so I need to try to move through this. 1 Corinthians 10, back where we were, which I didn't follow my own counsel and put my finger there. So we read in verse 10. Now let us also not, the fourth of his examples, let us not complain as some of them did and were destroyed by the destroyer. So what we have so far, don't be the idolaters, don't be the sexually immoral people, and don't be the ones who murmur. So making complaints against God. They do all of those things for the most part in this next one. They do the murmuring and the complaining, but they also get into the place of full-blown rebellion. And this is found in the book also of Numbers. Now, this is very early on in their sojourn. That's why it's really an interesting thing to consider all of those other things that we've read, with the exception of the first one in Exodus. Remember, the other two that we've read happened after the incident that we're about to read, which you would think that they would have learned their lesson early on. But they keep doing the same repeating thing of questioning God over and over again, even when he's answered the question. Now, we look at that and we think, when we've had kids, when they were really young, how many times did we say to our kids, how many times do I have to tell you this? We say it in total frustration, forgetting that we're the same way. Now, there's a time when we were kids and we think that somehow that we're adults, we don't have to worry about that anymore. I know what I was told, I can do this. Well, look at what they're having to do. God could have easily said, how many times do I have to tell you this? Or how many times do you have to suffer the consequences of this until you're going to get it through your head? Well, if they're any indication, never. So it's kind of sad. I shouldn't be laughing about this because it's tragic what happens here. The devastation of this it's insane. So Numbers chapter 13, this is when they're going to go spy out the land. So remember what's taking place here. God has brought them all the way to the very place where they just need to go in. And as I think of this, there's a question that should be asked in this. God knows the land that he wants to bring them into. God knows what's in the land. He's going to send spies in to go spy it out, but it's not because God doesn't know what's in there. Just remember this. When God sends the spies into the land, it's for them to go and see it. It's for them to survey and see it and whether or not they're going to trust God to get them there. Because if God didn't do this, he could have just made them go in. They would have seen all of the things that terrified them, and he would have conquered them. But they wouldn't have had any ownership in this at all. And I think that's a really important thing, again, because why would God go through all of these steps knowing exactly what they're going to see? Once again, the spies were intended to manifest the hearts of the people, not because God was in a place of a lack of knowledge. He knows all of these things. So in Numbers, let's read verses 1-3. And we're going to jump through a lot of this. There's quite a bit of reading in 14, but this is where it sets up. Now, what God says in chapter 13, verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying this, send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. From each tribe of their fathers, you shall send a man, everyone who is a leader among them. So Moses sent from the wilderness of Paran, according to the command of the Lord, all the men who were heads of the children of Israel. And it gives you the names of those starting at verse 4. What I want to point out, and it's really important, look at verse 2. Send men to spy out the land of Canaan, which I am giving to the children of Israel. if what was in the land made it impossible, then God couldn't have already, past tense, given it to them. So in God's mind, I've already given you this land. Go and see what it is. So it's not as though this is, as far as God's concerned, it's not in doubt. What he knows is what's going to happen when they go in to see it, and he knows exactly what the reaction is going to be. But this is the matter of accountability. It makes the people responsible for trusting God to do what would be, in their own minds, suicidal. But he's already said, I'm giving it to them. I've already given it to them. So look at verse 26. After they've done that, they've gone, they've spied it out. They've been in there for 40 days, and now they're bringing back their report. Verse 26, so they departed and they came back to Moses after the 40 days in the land. Here they come back. And I would recommend you do this. Read chapters 13 and 14 in their entirety, maybe tonight or tomorrow, and read the whole thing. It's a fascinating, fascinating history of Israel. So they came back to Moses and Aaron and the congregation of the children of Israel in the wilderness at Paran, at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them of all and to all the congregation, and they showed them the fruit of the land. Here's the things that we brought back, which is an interesting thing, because 10 of these guys have already decided, even though it's awesome, we cannot go. These are the people who should know better. They've seen everything. These are part of the people that were brought out of Egypt. And now they think that it's impossible that God could lead them into the land. I mean, how are you missing this, guys? So they come back and they say, boy, this would be great. How nice would it be for us to go in there, but we can't. So verse 27, then they told him and said, we went into the land where you sent us, and it truly flows with milk and honey, and it is and all of its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in that land are strong. The cities are fortified and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there, and we'll get to that in just a moment. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south. The Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains. The Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the banks of the Jordan. Then Caleb quieted the people before Moses. And that idea of quieting them is like, there's a whole bunch of commotion going on. They're saying, here's what we saw. It was great, but there's that group over there and that group over there. And everybody's all worked up. And Caleb goes, shh, stop. It's amazing what he says here. Look at this. Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, let us go up at once and take possession, for we are able to overcome it. But the men who came up with him said, we are not able to go up against this people, for they are stronger than we are. So again, circumstances. Doesn't matter how many we've got, they're still greater than we are. Because they're thinking completely in human earthly terms, no matter what they've seen. Remember, by this time, if it was one of those things about, well, where are we going tomorrow? I don't know. Let's wait until God moves the cloud. Then we'll know it's time to go. The cloud doesn't do that on its own. It's directed by God. You don't find pillars of fire, whatever that looked like. Those don't happen on their own. That's something put there by God. Same thing with the cloud by day. If God can do that, you're thinking that he can't do something about the land? For crying out loud, isn't it amazing how quickly we can forget? Bless you. Because circumstances will make us fearful. Unbelievable. Look at this. It's not that bad. It's not like, okay, well, it was a disagreement. Let's go home. It gets a lot worse. Verse 32. So they gave the children of Israel by their, and remember, this is Moses writing this. And he's obviously, he's got a problem with this too, because he's held accountable for, he doesn't get to go see the promised land. So the children of Israel gave a bad report about the land that they had spied out, saying, the land we have gone into as spies is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people who we saw in it are men of great stature. There we saw the giants, the descendants of Anak, and they came. Anak came from the giants. So it's a description. Who are these people, the descendants of Anak? They're those giants. So it says, and we were like grasshoppers in their sight, and so we were in their sight. They were just massive people. And it was that was enough to make them just go, all right, party's over. Let's just go back. Chapter 14, so all the congregation lifted up their voices and they cried and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if we had only died in the wilderness. Imagine this. With everything that God has done, this is what they say. So they said to one another, let us select a leader and let us return to Egypt. Now, wrap your minds around what that is. These were people who could be killed for no cause. Remember what ended up happening, how Moses intervened when he was still a prince of Egypt, because he saw two people fighting, and then when he saw the Egyptian whipping one of them, he killed one of the Egyptians. That's what they're saying. It would be better to go back to that. Really? So circumstances became so much, and they were so filled with fear, they would say, it's better for us to go back to our bondage. Let's make a New Testament, or let's just say, as Paul is saying this to the people at Corinth, the only reason he would give this caution is because the people at Corinth, would it get to the point, you guys, where you would think it's just too much? You just can't do this. It would be better to go back to what we had before we got saved. Let's just go back to our idolatry. It was easy. It was simple. There was no trouble with that. It was comfortable to us. It's what we know. Let's just go back to all of that. That's what they're saying. So forget about Moses. Forget about Aaron. Forget about everything that God has done. Let's select a new leader and let's go back to our bondage. Wrap your minds around this. And then ask yourself the question here and now, how many times have we watched people in the church that we know do precisely that same thing? Whether they thought through it or not, we've watched them go right back to the world that God had taken them out of. I've watched it. I mean, I pastored for years, and I watched person after person after person after person go back to where God had set them free from, and they went right back to it. Wow, man. And they did this of their own volition. Look at this. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel, but Joshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, they tore their clothes. They spoke to all of the congregation of the children of Israel, and they said, the land that we passed through to spy out is excellent. It's exceedingly good. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land, and he will give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear. Notice in their words there is no indecision in this. They are convinced of this. And because they're convinced of it, they can have that kind of conviction. There's not like, well, let's go give it a try. Maybe it'll work out. Let's try this and see what God does. You know, that's not them at all. It's like, what is wrong with you people? God's given it to us. They are his problem. They're our bread. Amazing. So what do the people say? Well, you know what? You're right. Maybe we should trust the Lord. No, that's not what they said. So all the congregation said to stone them with stones. So then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before the children of Israel. And man, I hope that I can see this on replay. Imagine this. You have only Joshua and Caleb saying, you're a bunch of cowards. God already said go in and take this, and you're saying because of what you saw that God can't do this? And then their whole thing is, really, you're going to talk to us like that? We're going to kill you. And then God shows up. Imagine that. Uh-oh. They know who's on the wrong side of the discussion when God shows up, clearly. So here's what ends up happening. And again, I know I don't want to be too flippant and joke too much about this. To me, it's a tragic comedy as I watch this. But when I hear what is said to Moses here, it's heartbreaking. It's gut-wrenching because God wanted so much to bring these people into this land. They rejected him. And he says as much. So the Lord said to Moses, how long will these people reject me? And how long will they not be leaving me? With all the signs which I have performed among them, this is heartbreaking as far as God is concerned too, because he knows exactly what he's going to have to do. I don't want to do this, but I have no option here. And this, for those people that say God causes people, to be saved or to be damned, how ridiculous. Because look at all of this is I've made this offer to them. They have of their own volition rejected me. He didn't cause them to do this. They did it to themselves. So he says, here's what I'm going to have to do. I will strike them with pestilence and I will disinherit them. I will make of you a nation greater and mightier than they." But then Moses said, remember, this sounds very, very similar to the burning bush coming down from that, getting the law and finding the people worshiping and all that. Same thing happens here. Not many weeks after the first time when he broke the tablets and all that, in the chronology of things, Kadesh was early on. And how do we know that? Because of what God ends up doing here. This is why they're going to be stuck in the land for 40 years. So the time when Moses comes down and sees them partying around the golden calf is just weeks before this incident. Same thing that he says to him in Exodus, he says to Moses here. So he says, "I'll make a nation greater and mightier." And so Moses said to the Lord, "Then the Egyptians will hear it, for by your might and by that you brought these people out from among them. And they will tell it to the inhabitants of the land, that they have heard that you, Lord, are among the people, that you are seen face to face, and your cloud stands above them, and that you go before them in a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar by night. Now, if you kill these people as one man, then the nations which have heard of your fame will speak, saying, 'Because the Lord was not able to bring his people to the land which he had swore to give them, therefore he has killed them in the wilderness.'" Because God, the world will say you could not complete the task that you said that you would. So again, Moses is concerned not about how this would look on us, not about the loss of life, but this would speak about you in ways that is so much more important than any of those considerations. So now I pray, verse 17, "Let the power of the Lord be great. Turn as you, just as you have spoken, Lord, saying that the Lord is long-suffering and abundant in mercy, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers and the children to the third and to the fourth generation." Do you know what he does there? That's found in Exodus 34, and it's where God gives, not 34, it's, let me look up the reference. I didn't write it down here. This is where God, when he first sees the burning bush, Moses sees the burning bush, and that's what I was like, Exodus 20. This is what God says about himself. He gives that description that Moses gives right there about long-suffering and forgiving the iniquity and all that stuff. That is Moses saying back to God what God said to Moses about who he is. And I think it's a teachable moment for all of us. When God says something about himself or demonstrates something to us, we should be able to say, "Lord, you have said or you have done this, and I've taken note of it, and I respond back to you in the same way. I recognize that you are who you say you are. I want to know him well enough that I'm able to say, this is what you say in your word, and I stand on it." Because it's exactly what Moses does. It's just really, really cool. So he says, "Lord, pardon the iniquity of these people, I pray, according to the greatness of your mercy, just as you have forgiven this people from Egypt even until this time." So the Lord said, "I have pardoned according to your word, but truly as I live, the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord, because all of these men who have seen my glory and the signs which I have done in Egypt and in the wilderness, and they have now put me to the test these 10 times and have not heeded my voice. They certainly shall not see the land of which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who have rejected me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has followed me fully, because he has a different spirit rather in him, and he has followed me fully, I will bring into the land where he went, and his descendants, they will inherit that." You can read about that in Joshua. When they come into the land, you read about Caleb and you read about where they ended up settling. And he basically was just, he said, when they get in there, he goes to Joshua. He says, "I want the toughest part of the land. I want to go there, and I know who's up there, and I don't care because God goes before me. Send me there. That's the land that I want." This guy, I cannot wait to meet him. He's Chuck Norris. So verse 25. "Now, the Amalekites and the Canaanites, they dwell in the valley. Tomorrow, turn and move out into the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea." So don't go and do this. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, how long shall I bear with this evil congregation who complain against me? I have heard the complaints which the children of Israel have spoken against me. So here's what you're going to say to them. As I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will do to you. Before I read on, let me make sure that I make this really clear. This is what is said when God descends on the tabernacle of meeting, or the place of meeting, where Moses would have these discussions with God. When they were ready to kill Joshua and Caleb, God comes down and he goes in there, and that's Moses' way of saying, uh-oh, God has something he wants said. This is what's said in that tent while everybody's gawking, watching all of this. They probably, some of them still have rocks in their hands. They were ready to kill Joshua and Caleb, and this is what God is saying in that tent as they're all wondering what's going to be said. Imagine this. Insane. Verse 29. The carcasses of you who have complained against me will fall in the wilderness. Remember, Moses is going to tell them this. He's saying, thus says the Lord. All of you who were numbered according to your entire number from 20 years old and above, except for Joshua, the son of Jephunneh, and except for Caleb, rather, the son of Jephunneh, and Joshua, the son of Nun, you shall by no means enter the land which I had swore to make you dwell in. But your little ones, whom you have said will be the victims, I will bring in, and they will know the land which you have despised. They're the only ones getting in. You wanted to use them as your excuse? I'll do you one better, you guys. You're going to die here. The kids that you used as your excuse, they'll get in. Now imagine when this is, you could have a toddler there that's going to be over 40 years old by the time they actually get into the land. Imagine that. Now, what about the kids that were just close to 20 years old? They're going to be in there right about 60 years before they actually get a chance to see it. All because of the parents. Consequences. Amazing. Verse 32. As for you, your carcasses will fall in this wilderness. Isn't it amazing? God calls them their carcasses. Your bodies, your carcasses. And your sons will be shepherds in the wilderness for 40 years, and they will bear the brunt of your infidelity until your carcasses are consumed in the wilderness, according to the number of days in which you spied out the land, 40 days. For each day you will bear your guilt 1 year, namely 40 years, and you will know my rejection. Can you imagine hearing this report? Wow, this is serious. So again, when Paul uses this example to the people in Corinth, and you can read the rest of it. We'll run out of time if I read the rest of it. You can go on through the rest of the chapter. But if you're speaking to the people at Corinth, or if it's just here in Manitowoc, we can read the passage there in 1 Corinthians, but you don't really get the weight and the gravity of what was said there until you go and read it all for yourself and then start saying, what does this mean to the church in the 21st century? Means everything. Because again, think about what the world puts in front of us. To the believer, we're always told, worship something other than God. Devote yourself to something else. Idolatry is just that. It's not just idols. Idolatry is that you put anything that is the rightful place of God ahead of him. That's idolatry. And I don't care if it's your house, your job, your family, whatever it may be, you can put anything in place of the priority that God has alone. If you do that, it makes it a very easy slide to go into the other things, all kinds of immorality type things, because there's no longer a standard that says no. You've already set that aside and you've pushed it off. So then the next thing it's going to be is complaining about it. Well, God this and God that, and you'll start to murmur and do all of that to the point where you finally get to say, yeah, well, he doesn't really care that much anyways. I'm just going to go back to the way that things were. He's able to use the children of Israel for a bunch of Gentiles in Corinth and say, learn the lesson, you guys. You're no different than they are. And actually, to the church, it's even a greater caution because the church has the Holy Spirit. Boy, we should know better than even the children of Israel. I don't care what miracles they saw. If you're indwelt by the Spirit of the living God, you have the greatest miracle that world's ever seen. So the idea that there's a caution even to that, man, oh man. Let's go back and we'll finish up in 1 Corinthians. In verse 11, now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition. So the examples are, let me give you a, for instance, why not to do what you might be thinking of doing. And they were written to encourage us or admonish, don't make these mistakes. Notice the last part, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Wow. So I believe that we should be very careful to recognize it is easy to get complacent. Man, the church has been around for 2,000 years and the Lord hasn't come back. We're going to be doing a prophecy conference talking about how the Lord is going to be coming soon. And it's easy to get really cynical because he doesn't show up when you think he's going to show up. Notice when he says is upon whom the end of the age has come, he's talking to a church 2,000 years ago saying we're at the end of things. Well, he miscalculated on the timing of the whole thing, but it does show that there's a very important thing that we, you know, the geeky Bible scholars would call the doctrine of imminency, or the imminence, the imminent return of Jesus. It could be at any moment. Could be a long time, but it could happen at any time. There's a difference between those things. But that kind of expectation that he puts there really kind of is a great bulwark against complacency. Why would I want to just coast when the Lord could turn up tomorrow? I don't want to be just found as, you know, treading water or biding my time. I want to be busy about the things that he's asked me to be busy about. And when he comes back is completely his business. I don't have to be concerned with that. I am just asked to, as a pilgrim and a sojourner passing through on the way to someplace else, I can do the things that he has asked me to do, and I don't need to be putting aside all the things that my flesh may want. I'm supposed to keep my eyes on him. That's an easy thing for me to remember. So it was to the church at Corinth, so it is to our church here today. Same thing. So let's pray, and you always like to do questions. Out of your mind. Pastor back in Texas does the same thing. Mark does questions and answers. I'm not that courageous, but I'll do it anyway. Father, we thank you so much for your word. We thank you for the encouragement that it can give to us. And oh, if ever we could learn the lesson, you have such a track record with your people. You have done so many things. May we learn from that history, the good and the bad, that we would repeat the things that should be repeated, that we would reject the things that should be rejected, but that we would walk in a place of integrity before you. I thank you for those that you've brought here today, tonight. And I pray, Lord, that we would learn these lessons. They're put there in writing for us, that we would learn and grow. We give to you all thanks and praise in Jesus' name. Amen.